So we start, like, I start, like, trying to have a Charleston contest.
Oh, my gosh.
So the girls will leave so that I can get back to writing Hostel and listening to Quentin read me Inglourious Bastards.
Oh, my gosh.
Oh, honey.
Welcome to the Oh Honey podcast,
where you get the sticky and the sweet with Summer
and Amanda and Eli Roth.
Hello.
So today is Halloween.
Oh my God, I'm so excited to get
this. Is like purposely planned this with you.
It's amazing that it worked out that I just came over and it's right on Halloween.
Yeah, like, it's just incredible. It's Halloween week.
It was so weird. I was walking down the street in my pajamas and I'm like, oh my God, what are Amanda and Summer doing?
Yeah, so, well, yeah. I'm a little disappointed, not going to lie.
You know, everyone expects me to be in horror, like, Halloween-y pajamas.
Right,
but you sometimes, should. You know, I just like wearing blue and looking all colorful.
I mean, it's contradicting a little bit because you write a lot of horror scripts like Cabin Fever, Hostel, direct a lot of horror movies. But now you do a bunch of other things, too. You have House with the Clocks.
I did like kids horror, spooky horror. I like to play against type.
Yeah.
I think everyone thought initially that I was going to look like, you know, when they saw
Marilyn
my
Manson.
Movies, they thought I would look like Marilyn Manson or Rob Zombie. And then it's like the nice Jewish boy.
Yeah.
It's just,
I like never it. Know.
You're into
yeah,
it.
Yeah, I'm into
look,
it.
Look, you can't change who you are. I mean, I've tried temporary tattoos and, you could, and I've tried that look and
did
it
you
doesn't.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, just, and I got, well, I got a henna tattoo once. I don't know if that counts.
Yeah.
And then I sort of like, when I get sweaty, I look like I'm wearing eyeliner anyways.
Oh, that's true. You have like the nice eyelashes.
Thank you. With the long eyelashes, I get like, I look like I have guyliner on. So that's about as goth as it gets for me.
Yeah, guyliner.
Guyliner. I like that.
I never heard that before.
Really?
He is a writer.
That's right. The word wizardry comes out. But I think that, a lot of times people do that, and I think it's an affectation.
Mm.
And I always just, I don't know, I try to be myself.
Yeah, I love it.
Really.
Well, you're also working on a shark documentary?
A documentary, yeah, about shark finning.
Yeah.
Because sharks are like the most misunderstood monsters.
It's so
because they're not monsters. They're like our friends, and they're really sweet. And I always, look, I like to show the worst in people.
Mm-hmm.
And I think of it as like a real life horror movie.
Yeah.
Because what we're doing to sharks is so shockingly, it's this insane decimation of an entire species
mm-hmm.
for something that's completely unnecessary, which is soup that's totally tasteless, these health products that actually are terrible for you and cause inflammation, and it's sold in supermarket with meat that's poisonous. It's really, really sad. And there's, 11,000 sharks an hour are killed.
Oh, my God.
Well, yeah,
I didn't even know that. That's
second.
Crazy.
Nobody knows. It's 100 million a year.
I didn't know that.
They think they're going to be gone within, like, I mean, or completely within 10 to 15 years.
Like dinosaurs just
they
extinct.
Are. I know, and I've seen it. Yeah. But they're the last, they're older than dinosaurs. Sharks go back 400 million years.
Wow.
So, and their function on Earth is to keep the ocean clean.
Yeah.
But they've been so demonized in movies.
Oh,
and
Jaws.
In pop culture. Yeah, exactly.
No,
that everyone's
no, no,
like,
no.
And it's not the fault of Jaws. It's really, it's people at weddings that want to look, you know, do it as a status symbol. But the problem is that everyone just assumes, oh, sharks are evil.
Mm.
And they're actually quite shy and very intelligent. And they're like dogs and dolphins. And they have personalities and families. And they're
They are
smart.
Just like dogs. I went swimming with the, well, they were nerf sharks. But
they are.
Yeah, but they acted just like
what
dogs.
What?
Nerf sharks.
I thought you said nerd sharks. I was like, you.
They're nerd sharks.
Yeah,
I'm a shark nerd, but those are, the nerf sharks in the Bahamas by the Pig Island.
Yeah, you just have to like close your hands because you have bait, basically, smell.
But they're
your
like dogs. They'll come up to you. They just want the fish.
Yeah.
They don't want to bite you. And
they're
just like when you have a ball and the dog wants to play with it and they come up.
It's so true.
I've hand fed reef sharks before and they're the same way.
Yeah.
They don't charge at you. They're not attacking you. They're just carefully, and same thing with tiger sharks.
Yeah.
Like they'll come in. I mean, I'm not like saying that all sharks are friendly and
so
sweet.
So go hang out with a great white. You'll be fine.
But they, but they're way more intelligent than people realize. And,
you know,
they're very sensitive, very shy creatures. So, and we're just demolishing them. So I'm making a documentary about it.
Yeah, wow, we need them for an ecosystem.
Yep.
So that's awesome.
There's a lot of misunderstood animals. You know how it's like, well, dogs are like the animal that everyone loves, but then it's like pigs are so, ew, it's a pig, and they're so frowned upon. Pigs are like smarter than dogs. They're
smarter
like
than a 3-year-old.
They're so smart.
I had a pig.
And they're not dirty.
Did you?
I had a pet pig.
What type?
I love pigs.
Wait, a big one?
Well, it started as a micro pig, but
and
it turns out
They always sell them like that, and then they grow and grow and grow, and people are like, okay, this isn't a little pig anymore.
Yeah, well, a micro pig, I found out, is like a micro person.
Yeah.
In that it's like a baby.
Yeah.
If you feed it, it grows. And, of course, the woman who sold it to me was like, well, I sold Paris Hilton her pig. Uh-huh. And I figured, well, Paris knows what she's doing. She's smart. She's pets. And then I finally met Paris after. I'm like, did you get scammed by the pig lady? She's like, I totally got scammed. I'm like,
really?
Where's your pig? She's like, it's 600 pounds. Lives on a farm. The pig, once the pig, Pennington, the thing with the pigs,
the name.
Pennington, the pigs are smarter than dogs to the point where you cannot train them. Because they know that the only reason to do something is for food. So they'll be like, come here,
you.
Come here. They outsmart you. Yeah. So I would sit there and clean up. I had a little like a litter bowl for Pennington. And he would just come up and he would just flip the whole thing over. And I would have to clean it up
and
like sweep the whole thing. And then I'd walk away and then he'd want to play. And then if I was leaving, he'd walk over and he'd flip the litter bowl.
He'd be like messing Pennington. With you.
And then sometimes I'd be on my iPad and he'd come and knock it out of my hand and he would just be like,
he's a bully.
So
he was.
Cute.
It was. I was basically, you become a pig's assistant.
Yeah.
I was sitting there on the couch and Pennington would knock the iPad because her noses are very strong.
Yeah.
And then he just wanted to like snuffle in
just
my chest.
Love.
And like pet him for like an hour. Then you put him down, not enough. And he would just look at me and just piss right on the couch. Doing it. And I go, Pennington! And then he would run back to his bowl and finish like in the litter tray. Like he totally knew. Once he started eating the Steinway, I was like, do not bite the piano. He walked in and was like,
oh.
He took a bite out of my piano. And the thing was, he was huge. So I finally found, it's actually a farm that's by a children's school.
Okay.
So it's like a petting zoo and he has a friend named Duke. And I get like updates. Aww. But now he looks like Pumbaa from Lion King. Like he's got the tusks. He's
really?
500
grow
pounds.
For years. People think, oh, it's a baby.
They sold you a boar.
They grow for years.
They sold me a wild boar. Like yeah, a proper, a like the thing, he could have eaten me one day. Like
yeah.
I would have woken up, you know.
Those things are dangerous sometimes.
Yeah. Very affectionate.
Yeah.
Very amazing. Smart, very funny. But he had a squeal that was so loud
that
like the neighbors were like, what is he like? Like, of course, I'm the guy who moves in the neighborhood and it's like, oh, he makes hostile and hostile tune. He chops people up. And then there's this pig squeal, which is not like a recognizable thing. You're not like, oh,
pigs.
That's the pig. It's this, Ree! It's this horrible.
Coming from your home.
Coming from my house when he didn't want to go out or you have to give him a bath. You have to put moisturizer on him. I put him in the bath.
Really?
Oh, you gotta moisturize your pig. I'm like, guys,
what?
I can't. Yeah, you got the pig, their skin gets very dry. Ugh. So you have to, you get like special shampoo and then moisturizer. And then they're like scrambling. And I'm like, I mean, this was every day. The amount of maintenance it took to take care of the pig.
That's a lot.
It really outweighed the novelty of
having
a
pig. Did you have your wife or girlfriend at that time?
Well, my girlfriend at the time is the one who convinced me to do it. She was like, and she's showing me all these videos. Of course, she went on a deep dive of teacup micro pigs, and she's like, and of course,
that's like a thing that's in.
What guy would get a pig unless his girlfriend was like, oh, get the pig.
Yeah.
So of course we were gonna name him Piggy Smalls, Notorious P.I.G.
Yeah.
We had like
so good.
Little, you know, we had sweaters that were made for him, and I ordered him, and he comes to the house. I can't. It's weird. I couldn't eat meat for a while. I eat meat now, but I can't eat bacon. Like after that, I can't eat bacon or pork because it's like eating your friend. And of course, she was like, oh, I'll take him on weekends, but never once happened.
Yeah.
And then
so
we broke up, and I was like left with the pig.
Pennington?
Pennington just sounded like a very royal, regal. Like I wanted some like very pretentious, pompous name for pig. I didn't want like
it's
Ralph
comedic.
The pig.
It's
I wanted like
more,
I wanted
Piggy
like little.
Smalls.
I wanted trumpeteers. We thought about Piggy Smalls, but it seemed a little too obvious. Then Pennington was a little more.
Yeah, it's a little corny. So
you'd be. Yeah. Have you done like a comedy?
Have I done comedy?
Yeah,
that's what I think he would do. Like when he got here, he's funny.
Oh, that's never a good.
What?
No, but that's
she saw you. She's like, yeah, comedy.
No.
Thank
when
you.
He gets here, he's like,
boy, you know, do you have a face for radio.
You know, when he gets here and he's making all those jokes about like, what he doesn't want to talk about, you're funny.
I try. Yes, at times I've been known to be funny. I want to make a comedy.
Yeah,
I mean, I think I've done. I would
I think
like
you can
to
do it all.
If you
but
do
I
a
like
comedy. I mean,
if only I could find some funny girls.
Let me know.
No, I was going to do comedies. I've had comedy scripts, but the stuff that I like is kind of edgy and somewhat offensive.
I think that's my
favorite comedy is where people go, you're not like you don't know if the whole room's going
like
to laugh or it's going to be like, get like that's
like offended or like.
Yeah, I just think it's hilarious. And honestly, when I'm killing someone in a horror movie, a lot of the times I find it absolutely hilarious.
Yeah.
Like when an audience is reacting and people are screaming. And like in Green Inferno, I was my friend Aaron and we're like, what's like the most horrible, you know, you just like sit around and you're like, what's the worst thing that can happen? What's the worst thing you can do? And then I just film it. And then when we're like cutting out his tongue and screeching out his eyes and chopping his arms off, we're like,
I love
we're
how
like,
he's laughing.
We're like gleefully laughing. It's the funniest thing. And then when audiences scream, I saw a running vomit from Hostel. I saw people crying and we were just like, I was in tears. I thought it was the funniest. I'm like the kid
that
played. You
love the reactions.
I love it. I love it. I'm like the kid that played a prank on the whole class or did something really gross and someone screamed and it caused total chaos and the teacher got mad. That's like my.
That's why the movies are so good though. It's because your satisfaction is from people's reactions to your movies.
I love it. I was never. I mean, for me, I was never like when I went, oh, I want to be a director. I want to get an Oscar. To me, the Oscar movies when I was a kid, I'm not saying this is always the case. As a kid, I was like, why isn't The Thing winning Best Picture? Why isn't Evil Dead Best Picture? Mm-hmm. This doesn't make sense to me. Like, who wants to see Gandhi? What about Ghostbusters? Like, that should be the best picture. So I always wanted to make movies that would just get, like, an insane, insane reaction. Mm-hmm. At my bar mitzvah, I wasn't friends with any girls. This is, like, there's more girls right now than were at my bar mitzvah.
At
my bar mitzvah? I wasn't friends with, and everyone was having these dances. And they would get, like, a DJ. And, I mean, this was, you know, this was the 80s. Bar mitzvah, mm-hmm. Newton, Massachusetts, like heavily Jewish. Everyone was trying to outdo each other with like winning the limbo contest. And then they get like the Boston Breakers. They were actual, like these Jewish kids sit around and like watch these like kids from Boston
and
come
they're
in.
Like, just, that's so funny.
And then try to do it. It's like, thank God there weren't cell phones around. But I wasn't friends. And my parents were like, do you want to have a dance? And I was like, what? Like a bunch of guys? Like girls thought I was weird because I was like a little Pudge Ball in an Iron Maiden and Texas Chainsaw Massacre t-shirt. And I got cut in half with a chainsaw at my bar mitzvah. I was like, I will do my bar mitzvah if I get cut in half with a chainsaw. And I found out that the magician learned the trick. My mom called every magician boss. They found someone and they found a guy that would cut me in half with a chainsaw.
Really?
And he's like, this thing's real, don't move. I'm like, so of course I was like screaming. Oh my, and I'm like,
it was real?
It was like, a real chainsaw. I was like, real, it was a circular saw that cut me.
You didn't take the chain off?
No, he used a circular saw, like the and I was really mad that it wasn't a chainsaw. I was like, I was like,
well, that's not what I wanted.
The trick only works with a circular saw. So he did a circular saw. The guy really did it. And like, he could have killed me. I actually could have been killed. I think about it now, but, and then we watched, it was hilarious at the time. And then we watched the horror movie Mother's Day.
And it was
like an axe in the balls and heads being chopped off. And kids were gore. I've never been happier. People were like, that
I've never been happier.
I was like eating pizza, watching Decapitation, being like, I'm a man now. This is amazing. This is great. This is what it's going to be like. But, you know, it's weird how you like, you have your mind set on one thing of, oh, I'm going to do this.
Yeah.
And then you actually do it. And it's amazing. It feels great.
Yeah.
You're like gleeful about it.
Making your dreams come true.
And nightmares. And then when you pass it on. But now that's
why nightmares.
That's why it's fun doing the kids movie with House of the Clock in its walls, because I wanted to. Everyone's like, when are you gonna? Everything I'd done was super R-rated, mm-hmm. so they'd say, well, when are you gonna do a movie that like I can take my kids
to? So cool.
So I wanted to do a gateway drug movie.
Yeah,
you gotta, like, hook
it
them.
Is. Yeah.
You know, like Gremlins, Beetlejuice. Those are like
get them early.
Get them early. Those are really great gateway drug movies because you see it and it's scary and it's like doing all these like, you know, forbidden things. It's a little bit dangerous, but it's still safe enough. Mm-hmm. So
I want to know the reactions of everybody at your bar mitzvah, though.
Oh my God! I had a cousin who, like, kids had nightmares. Like these
traumatized
were kids who were not
every other
allowed to watch
Jewish
scary
boy in town.
Oh my God! People were like, "These should have been T-shirts." I survived Eli Roth's bar mitzvah. I had my grandparents were legitimately in shock.
Yeah.
Watching me get cut with a circular saw, like everyone else.
That was real.
Is like going to bar mitzvahs and they're like doing candle lighting ceremonies and giving these emotional speeches.
Yeah.
And my cake
was like death.
My cake was a director's slate with blood. It was a director's slate to take 13 with blood splattered on the slate.
That's so
what did your parents think of you? Were they like, something's wrong with this child?
Here's the good thing. My dad was a psychoanalyst. He's retired now, but he was a psychoanalyst and professor at Harvard in the medical school. So, and my mom's a painter. So
they got it.
Oh, this is totally healthy. My dad's like, oh, this is Eli's always the best behaved. I was never in trouble. I was never in a fight. They thought something was wrong with me because I never got in trouble because I was so well behaved all the time. I was the kid that if the teacher left the classroom, they could leave me in charge. I was a neighborhood babysitter. I was a camp counselor. And my dad thought this was how I like, oh, this is how he gets out his mischief.
Yeah, it's right. Your outlet. This
is how, yeah.
And your
yeah.
mom being an artist, she already
she's
is
like,
the,
oh,
like,
it's special.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. She's like, it's wonderful. She's like, we, my brothers and I, we all had our easels. We had our art station. It was like, from the time we were kids, like our, I was very lucky. My parents are New Yorkers, and we grew up in Boston, where it was really like, what's wrong with you if you're into anything creative? You should have been a doctor, lawyer, banker. Like, you're going to be basically be starving and homeless if you want to be an artist. And I was like, you're all lovely people. I'll be in Hollywood making movies.
Yeah.
I really was like, I was mistakenly put here. I was supposed to be born in Hollywood directing movies. Like, I don't know what to tell you.
Yeah.
So I sort of never took anything that seriously because I was like, I felt like an outsider. I felt like an alien.
Yeah.
And I grew up in Boston in the 80s when it was just like, I mean, it's so interesting to see where the world is now with bullying and sensitivity. I had teachers that would be like, shut up, you faggot! Like, that
really?
Was not,
yeah.
Oh my God.
Changed, so
there
yeah.
was Mr. Cook, our metal teacher. He's like,
Mr.
His
Cook?
Mr. Cook, his catchphrase was, you stupid fag.
Oh my God.
I mean, he's dead now, so I can't like bring him back and make him a social media star, which
is
all I want to do. Because he's like,
that's all I want to do.
I remember like Mr. Cook, I'd be like, he would teach metal shop and kids would be like, Mr. Cook, I can't do this. He's like, yeah, well, you're a stupid fag. He's like, if you weren't such a queer about it, you'd know how to do it. And we were like, that was normal.
Yeah.
That was like the way kids
especially
talk.
For the older generation too. Like, you know, the teachers then, the like,
yeah, their teachers, yeah.
Yeah, zero filters Nothing. Whatsoever. It's like they didn't even have a sense. It was like a lot of ignorance too of just like not knowing,
yep.
you know, but.
Of course. Of course,
yeah,
you look
totally
back now
different
and you
now.
Can see where it came from. But
can you imagine someone saying that? They'd be on like, front cover of every news channel, like being sent to jail.
I know. No, we grew up with like, it was hardcore bullying.
Yeah.
Everyone just sort of, I mean, you could either like get crushed
sucked
by
it,
or you just, it was a Chris Rock who said, bullying is the fertilizer that makes you grow. And I was like, that's it. Like, you're just motivation. You're like, okay, you can all pick on me. You can all do this, but one day I'll be
but nowadays
a war hero
we have
in
little
a movie.
Keyboard warriors that are bullying.
Yes.
They say you a lot more hurtful things than, you know, like when people say stuff to you, like your face, like, it's not, now they say the most evil stuff on their fake profiles and stuff.
No, they can get away with more because it's not so direct. It's,
yeah.
They can
I was in the first wave of cyber sex when I was in college. And I was cyber sex, it was called back then. What is that? I love that.
Is it the shuffle one?
It's so funny. Cyber sex was a term that was created when the internet and modems started showing up.
Yeah.
When I was in college, I went into my RA. It was like, give the RAs in charge of the floor, my friend Bob. And he had this thing. I was like, what is this? He's like, this is the internet. I'm like, what's the internet? He's like, it's like blinking messages. I'm like, and it was, he's being paid by Penthouse Magazine to type like filthy messages and back and forth, what we would call texting or DMing. It was messaging back and forth. Doctors and scientists were the only ones on the internet. They were paying 50 cents a minute. He was getting paid like $12 an hour. These people were paying like $300 or $400 a night to talk to a girl. A penthouse pet that they thought, saying like filthy things.
Little do they know it's like this bull guy like
on the back end.
But that's the thing. I was like, what is this? I want in on this. And he's like, well, it's Penthouse. And there were ads in the magazine, like, talk to our pets. He's like, it's me and three other guys. I was like, I want a job.
Oh my
God. He's like, well, one guy's thinking about quitting. And I was like, so maybe you can take his job. So we went on his computer and we were just like, you suck. None of the guys like you. Your messages are terrible. Who'd want to fuck you? You're awful. And like, we bullied him.
Oh,
and he's like,
God.
I'm quitting.
Him.
And so I bullied him. And he quit. And I took his job. And so I got the fourth
terminal.
I bullied him out of a job. 1,000%. I heard he was like thinking of quitting. And we just, it's like
just
I pushed him off the ledge.
Final little
So I would start at like 9 o'clock till 3 in the morning. I'd be in my dorm room. And everyone, I mean, I don't know how explicit we could be in your podcast. But people, like, I had like 10 guys around and they'd be like, yeah, tell him to do this, tell them, like, and I got so fast at typing, then I was like, they're like, no, he doesn't get that yet, he hasn't earned it, he's got to be nicer. And then I would have, I had to have like 6 different personalities.
Yeah,
I was Mireille, the beautiful 22-year-old French girl who loved sunbathing topless in Central Park and couldn't understand
Mireille.
Why it was a crime. Then I was I was Tammy, the like, Tammy was like a hardcore, like heavy metal slut who had like gangbanged Guns N' Roses and Poison and loved group sex with lots of like heavy metal rockers.
Oh, right, right, right.
And then there was Allison with a Y, and she was recently divorced, and she would try, she was a writer, and she was trying to meet characters for a new book, but she was really bad at it.
Yeah.
And but then the guys were like, Allison, we don't want to have sex with you because we respect you too much. And I'd be like, really hurt, be like, no, please. But I'd do like a really bad job. It's like someone who's never talked dirty before trying it for the first time, using like very technical. And so I was switching in and out, and you'd have like 10 guys going at the same time. And
so you'd be like multiple personalities.
I was switching
and like,
personalities, and I swear to God, it helped me with writing.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Because you're like thinking of dialogue in character from this other person. So, and I sat down, and at some point my parents were like, where did you learn to type like that? Because I was typing like 100 words a minute. And I was like talking so fast. They were like,
I was like,
I don't know. I've just been practicing.
How you remember all this, every single detail.
Well he really built those characters.
Here's the problem I have. I have
Allison
one
with a Y. I'm like, damn, these details,
like,
I love it.
Who was it on Taxi? Who was the actress? Who was it? Who remembers everything that ever happened to her?
I don't know.
And I'm not at that level, but I have a very, very weird memory. And I thought that everybody had this memory, but I can remember things that happened like in fourth grade, like they happened this morning.
Really?
And I found out my brother was like this too. And we sort of realized, and my friends were like, no, Eli's the elephant. Like, he doesn't forget anything. Mm-hmm. And I can remember.
I don't want to do anything bad to Eli.
No, it's terrible. I don't want to remember. I couldn't remember math. I couldn't remember history or stuff.
Just moments.
But, like, I could remember, like, who arrived at birthday parties, in what order, what gift they gave me,
do
what
not
they
miss
wore.
A birthday party.
Like, entire conversations that I had in third grade, like, completely useless, superfluous information.
Yeah.
And I think, and I always say, like, do I write to stop the voices in my head, or the voices in my head would cause me to write? Like, I don't know. But there's a weird thing where, like, this podcast, I'll watch it, but I will, like, fully remember photographically. But just very strange.
Like towels on her
head. He's always going to remember this for the rest of
her Halloween outfit.
I'm sorry
you
have to remember
everything you do. No, it's not that I want to. It's like, it's garbage. I'd love to delete parts of it, but
what about dreams? Like, so me, I will have never remember a dream. Yeah. If I remember a dream, it's very rare.
Mm. Well, here's how to remember your dreams. Because my father's specialty was dreams. So he's a dream analyst. So I grew up with a dream psychoanalyst father. And analyzing our dreams was like the family activity. Like we would
sit
at the dinner table. Yeah. We would sit like at dinner at night or at breakfast in the morning. Because my dad worked out of our house, like in the TV show Growing Pains, which again was before a song.
Oh, Growing Pains!
So like,
wait, what was the theme song?
I can't remember the theme song.
Everywhere I go. Is that it?
It's weird because I was not like a big growing.
I think that was it.
I was more into Charles in Charge.
I don't know if it was Growing Pains, but there's this one theme song.
That sounds familiar, though.
Completely sidetracking here, and we'll go back to your. But I used to bike around my neighborhood singing that song, and just like, just by myself.
With a robe on her head.
Growing Pains, the towel on her head.
Yeah.
And
a silky black robe.
Thank you. We asked my dad, like, how do you. There's a technique you can do. When you wake up, that kind of first 30 seconds is when you can stop, lie totally still, close your eyes, and you'll bring it up to the surface and remember it.
Really? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Like if you wake up right away and you start walking around and do other things, it's like it dissolves like cotton candy, like it's gone. Or like, you know, smoke. It's just
cotton candy.
But I love cotton candy too. So I think of that every morning. So if you want to remember your dream, and you have a little notebook, I keep a notebook beside my bed.
Mm-hmm.
So if you, and sometimes it's crazy, like ramblings that don't make any sense. But a lot of times you can just close your eyes and then it's all right there. But if you don't do it in that moment when you wake up,
mm-hmm.
you won't remember it. And if you start doing it as a regular habit, your body and your brain starts to know to hold on to it.
Ah,
Became like a dream interpreter. On the set of Inglourious Basterds, I was the dream interpreter.
My favorite movie of all time,
by the way.
The Bear Jew.
Bear Jew. It was fun. And the best time.
Yeah.
It was one of the best times of my life doing that movie.
Have you seen Inglourious Basterds?
I think I have.
You would remember this scene if you've seen it, of him coming out of a cave with a baseball bat.
With a baseball bat,
yeah.
I'm gonna watch
Knock
it.
Him out of the park.
I can't do the accent. Guys, I'm like bad with how many movies I've watched. Growing up, we didn't have any cable. My mom really didn't let us watch movies.
She was on a farm.
So now on a ranch in Larkspur. People probably think I'm like some weird like hillbilly just like in the woods, like, but yeah, my mom like wanted us to like be outside and like,
yeah.
I didn't even know celebrities or anything until I was probably like 14, 15. Like I the only way I would like see celebrities or like I would like check out at the grocery store. I'd be like, who is this? We knew like Brad Pitt, like the biggest celebrities I've known. Like,
all the false
like Angelina
news.
Jolie. Like, I've known those celebrities, but like I've had to learn so much. So it's like, I have a lot of catching up to do like TV.
Well, how old are you?
I'm 22. You're like, you're old,
okay.
Girl.
Yeah, yeah. No, I'm saying you can, it's like, now's the time. Now is, you know, you wouldn't, now's the time you can start with it like Tarantino and you'd start with Reservoir Dogs and go through his movies.
Yeah,
like,
I just,
you got plenty
I just
of time,
to,
like,
to
start.
I need to learn it all.
Guys, yeah, Netflix and HBO and
it's
everything.
And now
right
I
there.
Love movies. I watch a lot of movies, but a lot of old movies that people talk about, it's not that I'm like don't want to watch it or it's like, oh, no.
Yeah.
I want to.
I never movie shame. I know some people that movie shame. And Quentin was
and
big
like
on this.
You.
Like when people haven't seen a movie, he's not like, you haven't seen that movie. He's like, oh, out. Oh my. He's
like,
excited
you
for you to see it for the first time.
So much better.
Right. See, that's
like,
the kind
like
of
you,
I
like,
need.
I'm like, jealous that you've never seen it because you get to experience it for the first time.
Right.
You get that joy of like, oh, I remember the first time I saw that. Like the surprises, the twists.
Right, because you can never unsee it. If you've seen a movie the first time, like there are movies that I would love to watch a million times, but it's like you never get that like first like.
Yeah,
like, you
so
know?
You get, so you're gonna, you got a lot. So anyway, so Inglourious Basterds, I was like the resident dream interpreter. We were shooting in Berlin, and I would interpret Quentin's dreams, and then
really?
It would get around the cast, and then Christoph Waltz, who plays Londa, who was amazing in the movie and won the Oscar for the movie. The first night he was like, Quentin was like, Eli Christoph has this dream. Before we started shooting, it was like the cast dinner the night before shooting. And he starts telling me this dream. And I was like, wait. Like, I got to call in the expert on this one. So I called my dad from Berlin. I'm like, Dad, this is Christoph. He plays Londa and he has a dream. And I just see Christoph is like, hello, Sheldon. Yes. Nice to meet. What? Yes, there was a mattress and an elevator. Hang on 1 second. And he left the dinner and he came back like 2 hours later and he just was like ashen and he had like tears in his eyes and he's like, your father is the most incredible man. I understand it. I see the character. I know how I'm going to play it. Like it unlocked everything. Like there's so much in our dreams that tell us what we're thinking, what we're really feeling. Everything we see that we think we're not picking up, every shape, everything, every interaction, every person, it's all going in there. And your dreams are where it comes out. So once you start discussing and analyzing your dreams, it's really one of the keys to kind of understanding what you're really feeling.
So since you're a dream
interpreter.
Interpreter.
Amateur, but yes.
Amateur, but still more than we are, more than anyone is. So I always have this dream, like recurring dream. It's the only time I remember a dream. Is like I always have this dream where it's like I'm running, but I can't run. Like I'm not going anywhere. It's like the weirdest thing. Like my legs, I can't feel them almost, and I'm trying to run, and I'm like not going anywhere.
That's the worst.
And I just like feel this like in my sleep, I feel like this feeling that I'm like just like feel like defeated. Like I don't know, it's like the weirdest feeling. And anytime I wake up, I'm like, was that a real dream or was that like, was I running somewhere? Because me, I'm a fast runner. I like to run. I used to run track and stuff. So then I'm like, wait, can I not run anymore?
What does it mean?
So I just want to know.
Well, it can mean several things, but generally, usually dreams, I mean, there's a lot of visual puns in dreams. And everyone's had that dream where you're running, you're not going anywhere, and you feel like your legs are in molasses, and you just feel exhausted.
I feel
and it's
it
the worst,
because
then you wake up, and you feel ripped off of a night of sleep, because you're like exhausted in your dream.
Yeah.
And then you wake up. Generally, that dream happens when you're at a point in your life where you feel stuck, and you want to get to the next level. And there's something in your career or in your life, whether it's in your relationship, maybe you're in a relationship that isn't moving forward, maybe there's a thing in your career that you want to advance to doing, an acting thing or a writing thing, and it's just not happening for you yet, or you're not moving forward. I mean, that's generally what that dream means. It's pretty obvious and it's pretty simple, but when that dream is occurring, next time you have that dream, try to stop and think about like where you are in your life in terms of relationship, in terms of career, in terms of finance. And is there something that either is holding you back or that you're holding yourself back from?
Right.
Because also, like, when you kill someone in a dream or when someone dies in a dream, it's generally, there's different, even if when it's other people, it's a side of yourself usually. It's usually someone representing an aspect of your personality. So try to, when I have a dream like that, I think, am I frustrated because I'm not moving forward? What is keeping me from moving forward? Are you, and you know, we all self-sabotage. You'll stop yourself from doing something because it's easier than, you know, it's easier than failure if it's someone else's fault. It's like, well, I tried to do that, but it, so it's your subconscious is telling yourself that you're stuck.
Right. And do you think that makes sense?
Yeah, when I think back to when I would have those dreams, because I haven't had that dream for a good, like, 6-7 months. But when I would have it, I think I was at a part of my life where it's like, I'm not happy with, like, where I'm at in my career. I know that I'm more than what I put on to be. So it's like, but I stopped myself from being that. So that's probably exactly
just like
what
since
it is.
Since you've met me.
Exactly.
I'll take all the credit for everything.
And it always it doesn't mean you won't have that again. I mean, everyone hits the point where you achieve something and then you're at a plateau and you're like, okay, am I ready? Is this where am I happy where I'm at? Or am I... You know, everyone always needs to be moving forward.
It's so hard for me to hear things with this towel.
I'll talk really loud. But it looks really good.
Isn't it weird that we all have dreams like that? Like, I thought I was alone in this.
No. It's like the dream of your teeth falling out, or the dream of, you know, being chased by some, the dream of being naked at school. I mean, it's all dreams about, here's the thing. We all have feelings of vulnerability, being afraid, and a lot of the times in our life, we don't allow ourselves to experience those feelings because, like, I can't just sit here and be like, we're all going to get blown up. Like, whatever that fear is, you know, we all...
Well, you'd be the worst guy to hang out with.
I put it into movies, but I try to channel it into creativity. But, you know, I used to sit there as a kid. I grew up in the safest neighborhood. Literally, Newton, Massachusetts was what it's like, safest city in the country. I would sit there and be like, someone's definitely coming in with an axe and is going to chop up my parents and cut my head off with a chainsaw.
Poor friends when you were little.
They're probably like, what is wrong? Like, they're probably terrified. So shocked. They have no idea that that's even a thing. They're like, what is he talking about?
All the time. I would think that. I was just like, my brain goes there. But I think that we all kind of bury those feelings every day. You know, whatever. Like, we can't walk around feeling insecure about relationships, whatever. And that's why we have therapy, is to talk about it. But that your subconscious, it's there. There's your conscious mind where we're at, and then there's your subconscious. And a lot of the times you're burying it, you're feeling it, and then when it comes out in your dream, that's when you're completely open, and there's no judgments and there's no filter. So that's when you're letting those feelings out.
Right. So fun. I have one.
Yes.
So I haven't had it. It was like when I was little, I would always have this dream, but I still have no idea what it means. If it means I would have it like every night. So I would wake up in my dream and I would walk downstairs, and I lived in a two-story house in Connecticut, and I would walk downstairs and it would be like super dark and spooky, and it was like Christmas Eve. And then I would walk into the living room and there'd be a big Christmas tree with all the gifts underneath it. And then I'd walk up to the Christmas tree and everything would be like eerie silent. Walk up to the Christmas tree, and then the scariest face of this old lady would come from underneath the tree, grab my legs, and start pulling me under the Christmas tree. What does that mean?
What does that mean?
Wow.
Next thing, Eli puts us in a movie.
So in the dream, you would wake up, go downstairs, and this would happen not around
the holidays. Mm-mm. But Christmas has always been my favorite.
Not
anymore. Or for you, Hanukkah.
Yes, because you're Jewish. We liked Hanukkah. It wasn't as fun as Christmas, though. Kind of felt ripped off. I mean, it could mean a number of things. And I'd have to almost know you a little bit better to truly know what was going on in childhood. But there's an underlying fear.
Grandma?
of the grandma, of the old woman, of the old thing that's going to pull you. I mean, it can get very personal, the questions that I would have to ask you to fully understand it. But it would have to be like about an underlying fear, an underlying happiness that was there in your childhood.
Okay.
That there's the surface of happiness, which are the Christmas presents.
Yeah.
And the safety of the family.
Yeah.
And then there's something underneath it that's pulling you that's either there or that you're afraid of. I think there's a loss of control. An underlying fear of old age, of getting older, of this ugly, I'm trying to think of what that ugly witch, that ugly thing
pulling represents. Me under the tree.
Pulling you under the tree.
Yeah. She was like, you can't have Christmas.
Something that's underlying that's going to take away your happiness. I don't know if it was not divorce or something.
10.
There was like...
Yeah. Oh, it could have been.
Were you divorced?
Yeah, my parents were going through a divorce.
It's the divorce.
Yeah. But I always thought it was the divorce was fun.
Well, of course, on the conscious level, the divorce is fun.
But deep.
But on the subconscious level, it's sort of the unhappiness. It's this evil force that's pulling apart your family.
That's true. Maybe that's what you're getting pulled
through the gifts under the tree into like an. That's probably. I'd have to know you a little better.
Yeah.
And talk a little more specifically, but you kind of going into, and also it's an empty house. You know, sort of like the fear of the empty house and the house being split, and this evil force that's pulling apart.
Yeah.
The Christmas is when the family's together, and this old woman, this old evil force that's
and maybe that you she under. Brought
my,
was
she
the divorce.
Pulled my parents apart. That was who did it.
That's pulling the parents apart. This older figure that's doing it.
But I did through the divorce. I was able to like travel more. My dad moved to Massachusetts to Munson. Have you heard of Munson?
I haven't, which is weird because I know pretty obscure Massachusetts towns.
Do you know where?
It's yeah.
another town. It's like another like random town. So
where? That's what it's
called. Yeah.
Do you know where? I'm like, he just said nowhere.
Yeah. Oh, but do you know where? It's
but
like,
do you know where?
Dude, where's my car?
Yeah.
Dude.
Where is it near? Is it South Shore? Or is it near Springfield? Or like what part of Massachusetts is it?
No idea. I would just go.
How far would it take you to drive to Boston from your house?
From Connecticut or from?
From Massachusetts.
Oh, we never went to Boston.
Really?
There. Yeah, we would always just go because it was in the mountain and we just do four wheeling and.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah.
So
we the
Berkshires.
We would just stay at the top of the hill and then go home. So my parents divorced and then I would go to Massachusetts because my dad had his new girlfriend there. So he moved there and then we would get to go to a new place all the time, which was super fun. And then he moved to New York because he got a new girlfriend. So we'd be in Albany, like back and forth. And then my mom got remarried and we moved down south.
Hey guys, it's Cheyenne Davis. You may know me from MTV's Teen Mom OG or Think Loud Crew podcast. I'm here with my dad, Papa Floyd, to tell you about our new podcast, Unfiltered Kitchen.
The kitchen is the hub of the household for many of us. The one-stop shop for conversations both big and small. Cheyenne and I have been having open conversations about all aspects of life in our kitchen since well before she was able to see over the counter.
And now we're inviting you into our own kitchen as a part of the family.
Unfiltered Kitchen is a two-way street. I share my advice on cocktails, cooking, parenting, and the lessons I've learned.
And I inform my dad what it's like to raise kids today, how generational barriers affect us, and the joys of being a daughter. Well, your daughter.
Get ready for a whole lot of unfiltered advice. You can take it or leave it, but you're never going to leave this table feeling hungry for more.
Listen to Unfiltered Kitchen wherever you get your podcasts.
I was the last option. I was the last picked in gym class for girlfriends. I mean, girls
really?
Wanted nothing to do with me.
Yeah.
I could not get arrested in high school.
No.
I couldn't. I really couldn't. I couldn't get a date. It's like, it's funny how it all kind of flipped for me later in life, where all the stuff you want to have happen when you're like 15, 16, 17, 18, girls thought I was weird. They thought I was into horror movies. Wanting to be a movie director was really strange.
They're like, good luck with that.
Yeah, exactly. I wasn't I wasn't terrible at sports, but I was not good at sports.
Yeah.
So I was like a theater kid and I was really into scary movies. I was like a fat little nerd. And then I started exercising. I finally lost the weight when I was like 14 or 15 and I grew a foot. But
I'm sure that extra foot and like the confidence of that kind of helped you.
It did, but I couldn't. I would go away on vacation to like upstate New York or something, and then on trips meet a girl or like hook up with girls. I mean, make out, like whatever it was back then. But I never had a girlfriend in high school, ever. I'd like think back to high school. And then when I was a senior, I went to France and I was an exchange student. And there the girls thought I was cool because they didn't know the difference.
You're foreign. You're like
I was foreign. So that was fun meeting. And that's when I started like I was like, oh, Europe is where it's at. These mm-hmm. girls are like women. I couldn't believe it. These girls were 16, they were like 25. They were like smoking, and they had makeup, and they had very cool clothes, and they were French, and they were like...
Languages.
We were riding Vespas. I was like, oh my God.
Yeah.
And they liked me in my, you know, Hard Rock Cafe t-shirt and all that stuff. And then when I went to college, when I was at NYU, was where I was in film school, I met a girl who was a dancer, and she became, that was like, wow, it's like I finally have a girlfriend. Mm-hmm. I wanted to meet a dancer. She was a dancer. I was a film student. And the problem is that I met everyone at college. Like you used to wait online to register for classes.
Yeah.
And I stood for 6 hours online and we talked, and I like wound up that night, we like registered for our classes, and I wound up like going back to our dorm room, and we didn't leave. So everyone who met us the first month of college, it was like, oh, Eli and this other girl. So then like for the rest of college, that haunted me. Because like, hey, where's your girlfriend? Like, because everyone met me initially.
That way, yeah.
And then I had another girlfriend. It's funny because we still like tease each other on our birthdays because they're very close. We're like, yeah, we're 25 this year. Awesome. I had a girlfriend my freshman year. It would just sort of alternate. I don't know, like the girls at NYU, we would start going up to Barnard. Mm-hmm. Because at Barnard, the girls at NYU, everyone girl was like gonna change their hair and get all pierced and tatted up and changing their sexuality and identity. It was like the girls at NYU go to NYU to go nuts and like rebel against their parents. And then you go up to Barnard and they're like reading you their poetry and they play Peter Gabriel. And they took me to my first Take Back the Night rally. And they're like, we're going to take back the night. I was like, what's take back the night? And it was like, all these women are getting up and taking back the night that they were date raped. Mm-hmm. And you're just like sitting there. I remember one girl just going, my clitoris is not a doorbell. And we're like, no, it is not. Yeah. And you just like you go to take back the night. And then she reads you her poetry and puts on Peter Gabriel. And it was like they have stuffed animals. It was amazing.
That's
it was
so
like
awesome.
It was like this cozy. You know, there were like these super smart New York City feminist girls, but they were still girly, whereas the girls at NYU were like
just going crazy.
Yeah, totally not. And then I think I started, like, there was a period after school where I was like in my early 20s, like 20 to 25, 26, mm-hmm. where I just went nuts. Like it all kind of clicked. I kind of grew into my looks a little bit and confidence and just sort of.
You're like, I'm sexy.
Yeah, I was like, girls like me. Because you have this kind of inner fat kid syndrome.
Yeah.
When you're 12 or 13 and you go to get your bar mitzvah suit measured, getting back to bar mitzvah, and they say, Mrs. Roth, your son's not a large, he's a husky. And I was like, which is a word for like fat Jew boy. And they had to get like a special suit for me because I was such a little fatty with a, you know, little junie brow. And I didn't know. I didn't know like what girls liked or didn't like. I was just totally, completely clueless. And it's like, I just would go on. I wanted as many crazy experiences as I could possibly find. And then when I was 22, I met this woman who was a writer for different magazines, which at the time were the big ones, which was Mademoiselle, Elle, Harper's Bazaar, Vogue, and it was her and Candace Bushnell were both like writing sex columns.
Oh, okay.
And so I was like her boyfriend, and she was like, come on, we're going to the Vogue party. I'm like, okay, what do I wear? And it was just like,
that's so cool.
This is Anna Wintour, this is this. And I was sort of thrown into this New York City world.
Into the fashion industry.
Into the fashion world, into the writing world.
Yeah.
And that was fun for a while, and then it got like kind of annoying. So I was like, sort of, what am I doing? And then
like, where are the chainsaws?
Yeah, and then I wanted to. I had written Cabin Fever, and I was trying to make my movie.
Love
I like
that.
I was and I was working on sets. It was. I mean, I wrote Cabin Fever when I was 22 with my roommate, and we thought we were just going to get cameras and go make it with our friends. And it was really. I spent 6 years raising the money, so that whole time I would work on movie sets. So I'd have to be on like five. I remember. You know, 5 a.m. and I have to get up and like unload the wardrobe trucks and work till midnight. I mean, I had to like, I would have to like quiet people down from screaming homeless people in the middle of the night and stuff like that.
Yeah.
It was crazy. It was fun, but I worked on Meet Joe Black. I got fired as a terrible stand-in.
Really?
For Meet Joe Black. Yeah, I got fired.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, for being an untalented stand-in.
What were you doing too much? Because that's really all you...
It's hard because it's sort of like being an untalented piece of furniture.
Yeah.
Basically, my friends were the assistant directors, and they were like... They said, They said, you can, okay, Brad Pitt has his own
stand-in. Do you tell your stand-ins that now?
All the time. Yeah. About, like, you are one untalented stand-in.
They're like, thank you.
Thank
you.
I basically, like, I was working, someone had said, you know, if you work as a PA, you get $100 a day. If you work as a stand-in, you can be in SAG and get $100 or $200 a day, but it all goes towards health insurance. You make a lot more money, mm-hmm. and you don't have to, like, really do anything. Yeah. And you can watch the DP light. Watch, like, the whole crew kind of working and lighting. And
yeah, it's like learning almost.
Learning, yeah. And so they said, well, why don't you stand in for this guy, Jake Weber? Mm-hmm. And I said, okay. So I showed up, and normally it doesn't really matter. Like, if your height is close enough, it's fine. And they were like, okay, Jake is, like, just a little bit taller than you. I'm like, okay. So the first shot was a two-shot like this of Jake and Anthony Hopkins walking side by side. So, like, I get in the frame, and they're like, is he tall? The DP's like, they're like, is he taller than you? I'm like, a little bit. They're like, okay, can you perch up? So I just sort of, like, go up, like, on the balls of my feet. And I'm, like, standing there. And they're like, okay, yeah, that's the right size. That's fine. And then they start moving the camera, and they're like, now walk. Now, I do this kind of, like, goofy velociraptor walk where I'm, like, kind of walking on the balls. And I know everyone on the crew because I've worked as a PA with all of them.
Yeah.
And everyone is just laughing at me. Yeah. Like, everyone's kind of stopped the set. Look at Eli, now he's an actor, now he's a stand-in. And everyone is rightfully so.
Slowing down the production.
The whole production is making fun of me, rightfully so, because I look ridiculous. And Martin Brest, the director, walks by and goes, who is that? And they were like, and she goes, boy, sister's AD, Amy. He goes, boy, that, they're like, oh, that's Eli. They're like, I got to tell you, that kid is one untalented stand-in, fire him. And so Amy Sayers, who I was friendly with, who I had been a PA for at lunch, she's like, she comes over to me and she's laughing. And my friend Chris, who I had helped get him the job because I knew one of the producers, they're like, the director, Martin Brest, just fired you for being an untalented
like,
stand-in.
How?
They're like, I was like, how can you be an untalented stand-in? It's like, he saw you walking. I was like, I was just going to get like boots with a heel and wear that tomorrow. And they're like, Martin says, you're too untalented to be on his set. And he doesn't want you there. So I was like, well, I basically turned down every other, like all the other movies were crewed up. Yeah. I was like, well, what do I do? They're like, well, you can come back and work on the movie. We just have to keep you far away from Martin Brest. So I had to be like in, I remember it was Brad Pitt and Anthony Hopkins walking down the street or the car scene. I had to be like stopping people from, you know, crossing the street and then turning the air conditioning on and off.
Yeah.
They were like, air on, Eli, cut, air on, air off. I like sat in the room. I was like, this is the worst.
You're regretting your walk.
It was terrible. Like, and then I think I sold something, got a writing thing. And then the movie was a huge bomb, and then Martin Brest went to make Geely and never made another movie again. So,
and you're like, karma.
Let's see who's untalented.
Yeah, exactly.
Martin Brest, you're more than welcome to work as a stand-in on my movie.
Yeah.
No, it's too
and
bad.
Then you can fire
the
him.
Worst part is because Martin Brest was one of my favorite directors. I love Martin Brest. I loved Beverly Hills Cop, Going in Style. I love Midnight Run, and I was so excited to like watch Martin Brest direct, and then he fired me.
That's why you never want to meet like your
idols
usually, because then
we were actually talking about that. It's like, I don't really want to meet you guys. Thanks.
Yeah, it's like, thank gosh, you're like,
sometimes,
you're cool.
Well,
oh, yeah,
thank you.
Look, yeah, that
was who I was before this morning, but
no,
it's cool. You know, look, there's some people
I
that
knew who he was.
Look, there's sometimes, look, it can go either way. Sometimes you can meet your heroes, and it's hugely disappointing, because you've built so much up, and then other times. Like, my hero in film school was Tarantino.
Yeah.
And he became, like, my best friend.
Which is so
cool. Which is weird in one way, but also totally natural because you're like, oh, this person understands me. They're making exact... Because when I saw Reservoir Dogs, it was the first time violence had been in movies in, like, 10 years.
Yeah.
And it was like, oh, someone who knows what I want, someone who loves the movies I want. This, you know, I was like, this, if I ever met him, we'd have so much to talk about because we like the same movies.
Yeah.
And he felt that way when he saw Cabin Fever. He's like, finally, someone that likes horror movies. But and then we met, and we were like totally nerding out. And then it grew into a real friendship. And then, you know, Bastards together was one of the greatest experiences of my life.
And so you were friends before doing that?
We were friends, and he came on, and he read Hostel.
Yeah.
I remember I had turned down a movie. I had turned down Dukes of Hazzard.
Oh, really?
And I felt really weird because I thought the script just wasn't great. And I felt like I screwed up because this was like, I'd only done Cabin Fever and this was a Warner Brothers movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I just thought like, shit, this is stupid. Like I'm supposed to do one of those movies to then get in the system to then,
but
you know, and it was not
didn't.
A horror movie. And I remember going to Quentin's house and I was like, he's like, what's the matter? I'm like, they offered me more money than I've ever seen in my life. And I was kind of going broke.
Yeah.
And he goes, well, obviously you said no, because there's a reason you felt like, I was like, I just didn't know how to make that movie good.
Yeah.
Someone else might, I just don't. And I go, he goes, well, what ideas do you have? Because you're a writer, you're a creator, you're like, you come up with your own thing. And I go, ugh, I got this one idea, but it's so sick, I don't know if anyone will ever see it.
Mm-hmm. So sick.
And he's like, what? And I told him the idea for Hostel, and he's like, it's the best idea for a horror movie I've heard in 10 years. You have to do that. I go, what if no one sees it because it's just so violent? And he goes, fuck it, who cares? He's like, don't think about opening weekend. Think about the weekend 15 years from now if kids are still watching it at a sleepover.
Yeah.
That's the only weekend that matters. 15 years from now if people are still right. watching it. He's like, Reservoir Dogs made no money. 15 years later, it's a classic. It's like, you don't know if it's going to make money or not. He goes, and if you do it for $3 million, you're not going to get hurt. Someone will make their money back.
Yeah.
And I told him, and I wrote it. I wrote it in like 10 days. And then I brought it to his house. And we went through the whole thing. He's like, this is good, but it could be better. Mm-hmm. And I remember we went out to the Saddle Ranch. He's like, let's go to the Saddle Ranch. So he's like, let's take the Pussy Wagon. So we get in the Pussy Wagon, and we roll up to the Saddle
Ranch.
The
car that attracts females.
And he pulls up to like nice and subtle in this big yellow, you know, the truck from Kill Bill that says Pussy Wagon on the side.
Oh yeah. Oh my gosh.
Yeah, like, he's like legit Pussy Wagon. Okay.
It's the Pussy Wagon from Kill Bill.
Yeah.
The big yellow one with the red, you know. So we pull up at the Saddle Ranch, and I have my script and my notes, and we go and we sit down, and we're like, and he starts like going through dialogue. Now this is like Quentin Tarantino, like my hero, who loved my first movie, is giving me script notes. He's like, I think that this guy wouldn't know how to use a gun. We got to figure out a different way. He's like, anytime I feel like there's movie convenience, I'm going to call you out on it. I'm going to call bullshit. He's like, this feels like you're not thinking hard enough. This is movie convenience. Mm-hmm. How would you, we don't know how to fire a gun. How would we get out of this situation? So we're like, and he's giving me, he's like, I've always kind of wanted to use this line. And like, we're sitting there kind of rewriting like the dialogue together and talking about the script.
Yeah.
And girls keep coming over and bothering, oh, Mr. Tarantino, blah, 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 Quentin Tarantino. And I'm like,
at this point, you don't even want the girls.
I don't want the girls around. Yeah. I'm like, I got Tarantino. So we're drinking like margaritas or this. And then the girls come over and they were like, and I was like, I'm almost there. Like, he's almost through the notes.
Yeah, yeah, come
but on. These like, but like three like really attractive girls come over and they're like, let's hang out. Here's our number. Call us later. So of course now his brain,
he's like,
before he's married, this is 15 years ago. He's like, well, what did those girls do? I mean, maybe he's like, I think we've done it. I'm like, no. Like, I got him.
Yeah.
He's focused on my script. So
he's like, I think we're good for today.
He's like, let's go back to, I'm like, why don't we just go back? He's like, guys, we're going to go work. He's like, let's go back to the house. So we go back to his house.
Yeah.
And he's like, we gotta like work some more. And then he's like, so we're reading through the
script.
So
you go back to the house with the girls?
No, with me and Quentin. But of course, his brain is like, well, are these girls are going to come by? So he's finally like, but I've got him focused on the script. And he's like, well, maybe we should see with those girls. Maybe those girls want to come out and go to like dinner with us. They said they wanted to go to dinner, right? And I was like, yeah, but wouldn't it be cooler if it's just the two of us?
Oh,
and he's like, yeah, but we're doing, you know, let's. And so he's like, do you want to hear some of Inglourious Basterds? This is 2004. And he starts reading me Inglourious Basterds, acting out the whole Hitler bear juice scene.
Oh my gosh.
The scene that I eventually, 5 years later, you know, 4 years later, go to play. Mm. So I'm sitting there and I'm just like listening to the most amazing dialogue I've ever heard in my life. And he's acting it out. I call it like Quentin Tarantino theater. He's like, 999, the bear you didn't. And he's like, I'm like, wow, your Hitler's amazing. He's like, I do good Hitler, right? Like, so I'm sitting there and then the girls show up and I was like, damn it. These girls are like, not only do I have Quentin rewriting the movie with me, he's now reading me from his new secret project he's been working for 10 years. Mm-hmm. And these girls show up and I was like, oh, what are we gonna do? And so the girls were like, hey, what's going on? Like, and it's just totally not the movie vibe at all.
Yeah.
They wanna go swimming, they wanna do this. And I was like, let's have a Charleston contest.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm like trying to think of the most annoying thing I can do so the girls will leave.
Oh my gosh.
And so I was
gosh.
Like, and Quentin's like, that's a great idea.
Oh, he loved it.
He thought it was the funniest thing ever.
Yeah.
So we put on the music and like we start, and I was like, here's my Charleston. And I start doing the Charleston. I was like, you know, in the 1920s, that would be like a thing to have a Charleston contest to see who could do it for like 3 days straight.
So great. You just set it up for like a 3 day marathon of the Charleston.
Yes. Yes. So we start like, I start like trying to have a Charleston contest.
Oh my gosh.
So the girls will leave, so that I can get back to writing Hostel and listening to Quentin read me Inglourious Bastards. And then Quentin's like, and then the girls are like tired of the Charleston. So the way they get out of the Charleston is they strip off to their underwear and they jump in the pool and they're like swimming around.
I was
like,
that's an easy out.
It's like, the girls, I was like,
they're good.
All right,
they're real
challenge
good.
Challenge accepted. Yeah. So I was like, all right, what are we going to do? And I was like, I'm really
you
hungry.
You take off your pants and you start doing the
no,
Charleston.
No, I was better. I was
he
like,
turns off the heater.
I was like, I'm so hungry. And Quentin's like, I'm hungry too. Let's get some food. Let's get some food. So we wound up going, Quentin's like, the girls want to go somewhere really fancy. And Quentin's like, let's go to this Mexican place on Sunset that's basically a step above Taco Bell. The girls really want to go in the Pussy Wagon. They're like, we got, because they want to roll up at some restaurant with Tarantino in the truck.
Yep.
Now, Quentin had his 1988 Volvo, which was destroyed. It's the car that he would drive around that he didn't care about getting dinged. But it was his car from before Reservoir Dogs.
Uh-huh.
And he's very superstitious.
Yeah.
So he likes to have the 88 Volvo because that's like the car that he wrote Pulp Fiction in and that would always get tickets and he had to sleep in that car when he didn't have a place to live. Like
this that blankie. Kind of...
Exactly. Yeah. So I was like, why don't we take the Volvo? The Volvo's perfect. He's like, let's take the Volvo. The girls see this 88 Volvo and they're like,
disappointed.
Very disappointed. They're like, well, we sure we can't try? Because this is like, Kill Bill has been in the theaters 3 months ago. So it's like, the truck, everyone knows the truck. Yeah. So
this is why we're like, here. Yeah.
Right. So they go, so finally the girl's convinced we get in the truck. It's okay, fine. So we go to the Mexican restaurant. The girls are just not impressed and we're just like eating nachos and blah 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 and the girls like they wanted to go to like some club on Sunset that would
cool
hide
vibe.
Or whatever was the hot club at the time,
get photographed maybe,
yes,
yeah,
that's what it was all about. And Quentin's like, he's like, I know a much better place we could go. The girls like, let's go to a club, we want to go out, we want to go dance with you guys. And Quentin's like, I know a much better place. And they're like, what? He's like, let's go to Plaza. And they're like, what's Plaza? And they're like, you don't know Plaza? Plaza's like one of the best clubs in the city. We walk in, we roll up the Plaza. The girls don't know that this is like a full gay trans bar.
Oh, really?
And Quentin and I walk in.
On Santa Monica?
No, it's on La Brea near Melrose. I had never been in there.
Yeah.
Quentin's like, it's a Mexican like trans bar.
It's like a theme.
And the girls walk Mexican. In and their faces are just like, this is not what we signed up for. And everyone's like, Quentin! And Quentin's like, what's up? And they're buying us drinks and all the girls. It's like a full gay trans bar.
Yeah,
and me
so
and Quentin are being treated like
kings.
Royalty. They're being so nice to us.
Like, welcome back.
They're buying, they're like, for Quentin, they love Kill Bill. They love the girls. Like, and all, like, everyone is fully done up.
Yeah.
Like, Latin, drag, full hardcore. And we're having
so
a great time. And the girls are like, finally, it finally boils over. And they're like, look, we really just want to go. And then, like, he wound up, like, taking them to a club. Like, he gave them
so
what they wanted.
Won.
They won. The girls won. And then, but by that point, it was, like, 11 o'clock. I was like, I'm going home. I'm going to sleep. But I wrote the script. I mean, like, eventually, I made the movie. I finished it and shot the film. And he came on as executive producer. And then we did Hostel 2 together. And then I did the fake trailer in Grindhouse. And then... Inglourious Basterds, he had been writing. He's like, I have this character, this Boston Jew. I've really had you in mind for it. And he saw my acting in Cabin Fever and in Death Proof, his film. And he's like, you're not pushing yourself. He's like, you really have it. You really could be great.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like when Quentin says that, of course. Yeah, and then, of course, knowing you're going to be on camera with Brad Pitt, there is no motivation like the on-camera motivation. If you know you're going to be photographed in a movie with Brad Pitt, you're like,
like, I am,
you know,
the bear
just went crazy. Yeah, and so I just fully went in it. And then afterwards, I wrote Man with the Iron Fists with RZA, the martial arts movie that Quentin came on as exec producer. So basically, every project we've done, it's just been for fun, where it's like one of us was doing it, and it's like, hey, do you want to be part of it?
That seems to be kind of how it works. I mean,
it's
obviously talented people getting together, but then it's just, you want to work with your friends. That's your life now.
Yeah.
Like, you know.
It's the best. And it's great to work with someone who is so much better than you that believes in your talent. That
so cool.
You can really learn from. That they're like, okay, no, this is really good. This is, you're on the, you know, you sort of need someone, like a mentor figure, someone you really respect to kind of kick you in the ass a little bit. Everybody needs it.
But you pay it forward too. Like, you, were blessed to have that happen in your life. But even with me, when I was like to you, I'm working on scripts and stuff. You're like, anytime, just send it my way.
I believe that. Yeah. I feel like I have a lot to offer, and you want to offer it to the people that will really appreciate it or get use out of it. Yeah. I mean, I've had a great time, you know, mentoring. I remember John Watts is this director who made this short film of a fake trailer of me directing this movie, Clown. Mm-hmm. And I contacted him and said, let's turn this into a real movie. And we did it as a real movie. And now he just did the two Spider-Man Homecoming. He directs the Spider-Man movies. Now he's doing a movie with Michael B. Jordan. So he's like, he's a huge director now. And and I love John. I just thought he was a great, great guy and so smart. And I, you know, was able to get him $1.5 million for his first movie. And that feels really nice. And then there's, I mean, look, when we wanted to make a sequel to Last Exorcism, we never quite cracked the title Last Exorcism Part 2. I wanted to call it Devil Inside, but then that movie took that title. And Damien Chazelle was like a 25-year-old math tutor when he came over to my house, me and the other producer, and we're like, he's really, really smart. And he had made an indie movie, and we're like, he should write it. Now, obviously, he probably should have directed it too, but at that money, he took that money, and he was able to make the short film of Whiplash and then make Whiplash because of that. So,
yeah,
you know, and then even with Man with the Iron Fist, I spent a year with RZA just helping him, teaching him how to write, and then he puts Dave Bautista in that, and then Dave Bautista gets Guardians off that. So there's certain people that, you know, and then Ana de Armas was in Knock Knock. It was her first English language movie, and she's blown up. And, you know, Lorenza, who, you know, obviously we married, but we did three movies together. So it's great. It's like when you find people that you really believe in their talent and you can help them and nurture that talent and they go on and do great things. It's just a great, I try to be that producer that I wished I had when I was trying to make my first movie in those 6 years before I got it made. You know, when you can give someone their break and they really deserve it, it's like a nice feeling of like, yeah, that person, you know, that's who you want to see succeed. And those are the people that you want to help. And then when they do succeed, you're like, yeah, it's great. It's like good for them. They needed, like, whatever help you can give them, it doesn't really cost you anything. It's not going to hurt you in some way. And it actually, it feels great. It's like,
if
it's
anything,
really nice.
Sometimes it comes full circle too. Then it's like bigger project that comes up next. So.
Yeah, it does. And you always learn things. Even when you're teaching someone something, you always learn. So I like it. I like people that are self-generators. I like you because I think you're, you know, you take what you have and you're always writing and thinking and creating and thinking 10 steps down. And you work really hard. And it's very, you know, it's when you, all those years I spent as a production assistant and working on sets, like when you find someone that has your work ethic, you really respect that, and that's what you respond to. Because I think everybody now wants the shortcut.
Yeah.
I'm sure everyone's asked you for the password of like, what's your password to get famous, to get, you know, millions of followers? Like, what is it?
Yeah.
But the truth is, it's finding something and working hard at it every day, and enjoying that process and throwing yourself in it and realizing how good it feels. It's exhausting, but you know, a lot of people want to do as little as possible, and just want it instantly.
Just having your passion and then just working towards whatever that is.
Yeah,
it's authentic. Would you say, just to kind of close this out and tie it back in with love, life, relationships, all that stuff?
I feel like we didn't even talk about that.
Yeah, but you know, I feel like your love is your work.
Yeah, it's true.
Yeah, so that's what it is. You can love your work and then just be working the rest of your life. And
no, I always tell everyone, I was like, any relationship I get into, it's like I'm married to directing, just so you know. You have to be okay with that.
Yeah, you got
to
be
you're basically my love affair.
Yeah.
You're like my side piece.
And
first thing is
there's
directing.
People that, if that's that communication, if you know that, then, you know, it's a good relationship.
Yeah.
Even as, like, second best.
Yeah.
Just have to have a girl that's okay with being a side bitch.
Yeah. We didn't even go into the honeypot. I was just so interested in all this. We could talk for hours and hours, but thank you guys so much for watching Oh Honey. You can check the links below, check out all of Eli's stuff, check out his movies. Summer's gonna watch Inglourious Basterds for sure.
Yeah, and I'll let you know what I think.
Finn, my shark documentary.
Oh, Finn! Yes, watch Finn, and actually watch the movies that he wrote and directed himself. So check them all out. It'll all be below if you're on the visual for the YouTube video, but also for the podcast, make sure you're downloading our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, all the platforms that you consume.
I think it's iTunes too. And make sure you send in your juicy stories below. Lots of detail to diary@ohhoneydiary.com. And we didn't get into pot today, but no. We will tomorrow. I mean, we will later, so send in
next week
your shades.
Bye, guys. Love you.
Oh, honey. Diary LLC makes no warranty or guarantee as to the accuracy or sufficiency of the information featured in this podcast. The information and recommendations presented in this podcast are general opinions only.
This podcast should not be considered professional or expert advice. Reliance on the information provided in this podcast is done at your own discretion.
Oh, honey.